From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Castro, Fillmore District.
Bernal Heights.
Oakland, California.
Coming up, we go behind the scenes of a booming sector of the Northern California economy, the marijuana industry.
I think a lot of us are calling our present job site Weedtopia, Trimtopia, because it's so fantastic to be here.
Then we'll visit an East Bay pet store that's not exactly warm and fuzzy.
Bearded dragons especially, their mating rituals are completely barbaric. I wish it was a polite dance, but it's more like Miley Cyrus twerking.
And we'll tell you the story behind this week's audiograph mystery sound.
The biggest pipes are 32 foot long. That's a big pipe. So when you get that low, that's when you start feeling the vibrations.
We've got a piping hot show for you today on Cross Currents. There's been a lot of buzz lately about the booming Silicon Valley, but tech is not the only part of California's economy that's thriving. Up north, another region has developed a catchy nickname. They call it the Emerald Triangle. Humboldt, Trinity, and Mendocino counties, and its growth industry is marijuana. In Mendocino specifically, the gradual decline of the lumber trade has led to pot becoming one of the county's major commercial crops over the last decade. For the federal government, marijuana production is still a major crime, one that can land you in prison for decades. But cultivating and selling the drug for medical use is legal in Mendocino County. What does it mean for a whole community to evolve around a legally ambiguous business? KALW's Daphne Matsuraki spent a day on a licensed medical marijuana farm to give us a behind-the-scenes look into the process. A note to our listeners, all characters in the story asked to remain anonymous. We gave them pseudonyms.
The marijuana farm is on a dirt road between Mendocino and Conche, around 2.5 hours from San Francisco. When I get there, the gate is wide open. It's a beautiful plot of land.
We look out over conifer trees to a valley with a beautiful ridge on the other side. This is like a million-dollar view.
Literally. This is one of the owners of this very profitable operation. We'll call him Tom. He works with a couple to run this farm. We'll call them John and Amy.
When we started here, this entire area was all like a struggling apple orchard.
John moved here with Amy and their daughter 8 years ago to grow weed. At the time, John was a carpenter and Amy a teacher.
She drugged me out here because her entire family migrated.
First, he had to learn the basics of farming marijuana, but quickly he became an expert.
After 3 years of living in California, I started experimenting with like organic farming, and that changed everything, really, on quality and yield and everything.
Now the garden has 25 marijuana plants, each about 6 feet tall. John's partner Tom is also a chef and a winemaker. He compares growing weed to growing grapes.
The process is very similar. You know, with bud, it's like it's about the crystallization. You look at it, the color, how it's finished, various things like that.
And these traits translate into quality and profit.
We're probably making about $1,000 profit on every pound.
So how many pounds were there, you said?
About 170. So
$170,000
divided by two, that would be
85,000.
And that's one outdoor growing season. They also grow indoors. So in a year, they're potentially making over $500,000. Untaxed, of course.
So now are we going to the drying room?
This is the drying room.
Oh, it smells of marijuana.
Yes, it does. So this is an actual indoor growing facility that we converted into a drying facility just for the time of the outdoor harvest.
The buds hang here for about a week after being harvested from the plants. When the indoor growing begins, this room will be filled with seedlings grown under artificial light.
No, we do 99 on the indoor.
Is that allowed?
That's the federal allowance. Anything over 99 plants, the federal government can prosecute the mandatory minimum
I mean,
in California.
They could prosecute you for one, but they wouldn't mess around with that, basically, is what you mean, right?
No.
I thought, like, no matter what federally you were...
So let's pause here for a minute. Because this is where the legal gray area gets grayer. Even Amy and John don't seem to know where the law stands. See, John, Amy and Tom have a license from the county to grow 25 plants for medical use. But obviously, at 99 plants, their indoor facility would far exceed that. The rule of thumb among growers is if you stay under 100, you're safe. I called a local dispensary to confirm this, and the director said federally, even one plant is illegal. But a grower is more likely to be prosecuted if he grows over 99 plants. Last year, the partners say their harvest was interrupted by federal helicopters. Agents came down on ropes and chopped down their entire crop. That's about $200,000 worth of weed.
It's such a weird gray area. For us, they came in and they chopped them, but they didn't prosecute. But if we would have had 100 plants, they could have brought in the federal part and prosecuted for mandatory minimum in California.
Which is 5 years. But his wife, Amy, says that she doesn't lose any sleep over their business.
Compared to some people have 1,000 plants.
And
those
what?
People are afraid all summer long.
After the weed is dried, it's time to trim it.
I'm picking up a bud and then taking off the big leaf and then making it into a pretty shape and cutting the stem.
Inside a tent, there are grocery bags of weed everywhere. People have come here from all over the world to trim.
I'm from Canada, from Vancouver, and I live in Mexico.
This woman has been here for 2 months, but others have become local full-time trimmers.
I've lived in Mendo for just over 4 years.
At first, this local trimmer had a regular tax-paying job.
And, of course, you can't necessarily make a living off of that. And when you spend a little bit of time here and learn what the industry is here, you learn that that's actually how you can either supplement an income or change your income completely.
It's long, mind-numbing work. But if the weed is easy to trim, a fast worker can turn around 3 pounds in a day, making about $175 per pound. Apart from the financial benefits, she says there are other perks that draw people here.
I think a lot of us are calling our present job site Weedtopia. We have a chef who is cooking for us every day. They provide us with anything that we ask. Music, entertainment, good conversation, the random people that you meet. It's all fantastic.
I find two other trimmers on their lunch break who have been in the business for a long time.
My parents grew growing up, so I started trimming like 8 years old or so.
For me, I would say kind of off and on from when I was about like 16 until now. I'm 34 now. And
for them, the marijuana industry is a way of life. They believe in the healing and the medicinal values of the herb. But they're still not open about what they do.
Obviously, when I meet a lot of people, it's not the first thing I tell them about myself. I mean, I am a mother, too.
The entire community is in a similar position. For instance, the growers, John and Amy, have a 7-year-old daughter who regularly comes in and out of the farm. They say it's normal for her.
Because that's what all of her friends' parents do as well.
Even some of her teachers. But there is a very clear social rule around here.
If I'll go into my daughter's school and talk to somebody, a teacher or somebody else there, you know, they would never, ever ask you, what do you do for a living? Because they know better, because they don't want to, like, they don't want you to put you in a position where you have to lie to them.
Perhaps the most dangerous part of the pot growing operation comes at the very end, the delivery. It's the riskiest step because it means leaving the safe haven of Mendocino.
It's going to Los Angeles. That's our hub.
Who takes it from here to go to who? I mean, another one.
Me. Yeah, me.
How much? So you drive with how much weed on you?
Legally, 49 pounds at a time. With our particular license, 49 and under, you have a really good case. But anything over 50 and up, you're in big trouble.
And where do you put the weed?
In the back of my trunk.
Like what in?
In bags.
Okay.
Duffel bags.
Is your heart racing when you do that?
No, it's just... I have my whole little, like...
It's a mindset.
It's a mindset. I just blow kisses and say, Daddy will be back in 3 days, and I go.
And are you worried?
Mm-hmm. I try not to think about it. And then when I get the message, somehow he'll get a message to me that he's there. And then I'm...
Despite the high risks and uncertainty, John and Amy actually prefer their business stay as it is, illegal. They're afraid of what would happen to their bottom line if they had more competition. But their partner Tom sees it differently.
You still can get your price if you do a boutique, high-end quality product. It's the same in the wine.
Would you rather it be legal or
are you? I don't care because it's no different than growing grapes. There's always a high-end market.
Hey, Dad saw you earlier.
And just like at the end of a grape harvest, this weed growing season ends with a party. All the workers gather around a big bonfire, burning what's left of the marijuana plants. You can almost forget that these people are in hiding, because they're hiding in the open. In Mendocino, I'm Daphne Mazziaracchi for Cross Currents.
For more news of marijuana locally and beyond, read our weekly online Cannabis News Roundup. You'll find new content every Friday afternoon at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. That sound we're hearing, it's not radio interference. It's scratching.
One of our big monitors scratching at the corner of his cage.
That's reptile enthusiast Owen Mertz at the East Bay Vivarium. And he's talking about a giant lizard called an Argus monitor. This scratching Argus monitor lives alongside approximately 10,000 other animals at the East Bay Vivarium, which is a specialty reptile and amphibian shop on 5th Street in Berkeley. It's been operating for more than 40 years as both a store and a hands-on educational center of sorts. Sometimes, staff members will even take a reptile or two out of their cages so visitors can get up close. Visitors, including KALW's Rachel Wong.
Somebody asked me to put these guys up here. $20.
I'm standing in the back of the bustling East Bay Vivarium with its co-owner, Owen Merckx. We're looking through the glass of a large cage at a lizard that's nearly as long as I am tall.
His name is Elmo. He's a good guy. People love him.
Elmo is a giant black throat monitor. He looks nothing like the Sesame Street Muppet with the same name. But apparently, their personalities have some things in common.
People don't expect that an animal that big and fearsome looking is actually a big sweetheart, but he is.
I don't totally see it, but I'll take his word for it. We move on to the next cage. The vivarium feels a lot like a neighborhood hardware store, but instead of drills or bolts, there are rows of turtles, frogs, lizards, and the occasional aquarium accessories. Down crowded aisles where you might otherwise find toilet snakes, the snakes on display here are real.
Right now we're walking down our monitor aisle, which is our large lizards and large boa constrictors and pythons, and assorted other odds and ends.
When he says large, he means it. The albino Burmese python in the corner cage is over 15 feet long.
One of the reasons we have the giant snakes in here Some stores will sell a baby python without ever giving anybody the indication of what to expect. So we like to have examples of what is this going to turn into.
It's important people know what they're getting into, because otherwise they end up back at the store, returning pets they can't take care of. That's how the vivarium gets some of its animals. Others are purchased from wholesalers, and others come from the breeding room in the back of the store. That room is filled with incubators and baby animals, and it's off limits to customers. So we move down the next aisle. Merckx takes a small snake out of its cage for a closer look.
Fantastically beautiful pattern on top. Nobody could deny that, right?
Yeah. Could I touch him?
Sure. Oh. But flip it over. There's a totally different pattern there.
Oh, wow,
equally nice.
The black and white pattern on the underbelly of the bright orange corn snake looks undeniably cool, like piano keys, and feels slippery. I suddenly wonder if I should be wary about touching any of these reptiles.
We have some mildly venomous snakes. Nothing I would consider dangerous. Probably the most dangerous animal we have in the store in terms of venom is beaded lizards. So a lizard that's venomous, and it won't kill you, but it might make you wish you wanted to die.
Turns out the beaded lizard Merckx is talking about is in a cage near my feet. I'm only mildly reassured by its metal lock as I scurry past. The vivarium has been open less than an hour, and it's already abuzz, mostly with people picking up pet supplies, workers caring for animals, and the occasional kids and parents wandering the aisles.
Look what a good climber he is.
Yep.
Then it's time for a feeding. Manager Carlos Haslam goes to the back room and returns with a yellow chick. That's when my adrenaline really starts pumping.
Yeah, this is called a scrub python. They're one of the largest arboreal snakes on the planet.
Haslam tosses the chick into the python's cage. The snake wraps his body around the chick till it passes out and then takes it whole down the hatch. I can't believe I'm watching this, but Haslam tells me he thinks most people are fascinated by feedings.
Kind of mechanically efficient, don't you think?
So fast.
Efficient, yes. But I'm ready to move on, for sure. The mood finally lightens as we shift our attention to some reptile mating rituals just across the aisle. Haslam pulls a male bearded dragon out of his cage. The lizard immediately notices a female in the cage above him. He stares at her and waves his legs like he's swimming in place.
If he could have access, I'm sure he would be all over her like white on rice.
Haslam tells me that reptiles and amphibians aren't the only ones doing a mating dance at the vivarium.
It's pretty typical. If a woman brings her boyfriend down and the woman pretends to be afraid, then she's looking for the comforts of that man. If a man does it, he might be looking to show his softer side to the woman.
Lovers and lovers of reptiles, I'm starting to wonder about the type of people who take this on as a hobby.
The face of the hobby is kind of eclectic. We have soccer moms from Danville. We have gangsters from Oakland. We have kids from Marin.
Owen Merckx has his own theory about what makes reptile owners tick.
More traditional pet, saying dogs and cats and the big cytokines, the big birds. People like those because in the end, they're substitute babies. The thing with reptiles and arachnids and things like that is different. It's not you making them into little humans. It's them letting you into their world. And that is as wonderful an experience as you can have. Not being yourself for a little while, that's incredible. That's great.
Possibly even greater than that are these moments of affinity you may end up sharing with an animal so completely different than you. Before I head out, I stop by Rudy the tortoise's cage. He opens his mouth wide and yawns, and I can't help but smile. Who would have thought a tortoise could make my heart melt just a little? In Berkeley, I'm Rachel Wong for Cross Currents.
You can see photos of some of the creatures for sale at the vivarium on our website. Go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
You can start out with the 8 foot, which is your basic foundations like that, and then an 8 foot pipe, when you cut it in half and you make it a 4 foot, it speaks an octave higher. So then you would add that, and then a 2 foot, another octave higher, and the mixture means it's actually 4 or 5 feet pipes speaking at once.
We asked you to tell us what that was and where we recorded it. A lot of you thought you knew where that was, but you were on the wrong side of the bay.
Davies Symphony Hall.
The Castro Theater.
Palace of Legion of Honor.
Grace Cathedral.
Grace Cathedral.
Grace Cathedral.
Grace Cathedral.
That's my guess. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
To bring us the answer, we sent KALW's Julie Kane to downtown Oakland to learn about one of the Bay Area's newest pipe organs.
So there are 5,298 pipes, and all of them provide a different sound. I'm Rudy DeVos, Director of Music for the Cathedral of Christ the Light, and we are inside the Cathedral of Christ the Light, right on Lake Merritt in Oakland, California.
How does the music get from the organ to the pipes? How does it work?
I mean, this is a major piece of computer equipment here, and electronically, through these cables, it sends the messages, you know, as to which stops, which pipes are supposed to speak, and when you press the key, which ones are supposed to open and let the wind through. You know, back in the day, even, I mean, as complicated as this instrument now is, but even when you look at historic instruments, like, say, 17th century or so, the organ was basically the spaceship of their day. A very complicated piece of machinery. You have these four keyboards here, and you have the pedal board down there, and you have all these little draw knobs here on the side. For example, you have some flute sounds. Then you also have stops that might imitate very loosely the oboe. The biggest pipes are 32 feet long. That's a big pipe. So when you get that low, that's when you start feeling the vibrations. Very often, yeah, of course, as people come into the cathedral, I mean, with it being a cathedral and open, you know, all day until 8 o'clock in the evenings, you have people often walking into the cathedral, of course, and then when I would be practicing, usually sometimes I play things half tempo and practice it slowly, so it's not really always a performance like it is now. But they do enjoy hearing the organ, of course.
You can find out how to hear upcoming concerts and see a demonstration of the pipe organ at the Cathedral of Christ the Light on our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. And that does it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Laura Flynn, Christina Loring, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Chris Hoff, Ryan Miller, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show is produced by Julie Kane and engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, Martina Castro is our senior producer, Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. This band is known as the Cottontails. The Cottontails are almost the house band at the Riptide, way out near the edge of the continent in the avenues of San Francisco. You can hear them Sunday, starting at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.